Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is the Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Yusuf Danik for another episode of Retro Cooking Show. I don't know what we're calling this thing. This time, we're discussing Grillade from The Galloping Gourmet in 1970. We talk about Graham Kerr's personality, how the presentation rubs us the wrong way, and the ways we veer from the given recipe. The Galloping Gourmet was a show I'd never watched before, so this was an interesting trip back in time to 1970. This was fun, as always. On to the discussion! Hello, everyone. I'm here with Yusuf Danik. I don't think we have a name for what we're calling the sequence of episodes. Old food show with Robbie and Yusuf.
That sounds so very enticing.
I am a marketing
journey into leftovers.
I'm a marketing genius.
You really are.
Hence all my podcast success. Yusuf, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm all right. This episode, we are making some Grillade with The Galloping Gourmet. There's some good alliteration there.
It is very alliterative.
It would be Grillade and grits with The Galloping Gourmet, but he does not like grits. He actually hates grits, as he makes very clear in this episode.
He was several times, and he goes to a restaurant to try the food that he was going to make, I guess, to learn how to make it. I'm not sure. It's like maybe like Highlander, like culinary Highlander. He has to like decapitate the dish and steal its quickening so that he can then cook it. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. He goes to a place and is like, oh, these grits are terrible. I hate them. They're so bad. Thanks for making them for me.
I don't think that's inconsequential because it is part of the show. He literally does go to a place every single episode and has a little travelogue where he talks to the audience and shows them, here, look, this is me going to this place. I hated the food. Let me make it.
It was odd. I was going to suggest, initially I did suggest an episode where he makes a giant cut of meat that he like sticks pork fat into and then covers with oysters at the end, which is gruesome, but he went to a place and had the food, and it was also very strange. Like, it's just like he's like goes to a place. Maybe that's the crux of his show, though. It's like, you know, you can go to these fancy places and eat very high class, fatty beige food, or you can bring that poison into your home.
I think I've heard the words Galloping Gourmet before, but I've never watched this man before ever in my life before this, before preparation for this podcast.
I did not know he was the Galloping Gourmet. I knew him only as Graham Kerr because as an inside kid, when we got cable, I really watched a lot of cooking shows because it was nice to have someone to talk to me.
Indoor kid?
Oh, yeah.
I watch cooking shows. I never watched this cooking show. Graham Kerr, he is the Galloping Gourmet. The Galloping Gourmet, at the show itself, was very popular, but it only lasted for 2 years.
Really?
Yes. It was 1969 through 1971. This episode from the second season, 1970. He and his wife got in a horrible car accident, and the show did not survive. He returned back to television and has done many different shows through the years. He's still alive. He's 83, but the Galloping Gourmet only lasted for 2 years, only 2 seasons, I suppose, or 3 seasons through over three, I guess 69, 71. So that's 3 years, technically 3 seasons, 3 years.
How is it? Was it just in reruns or it established? Cause I mean, we both know the Galloping Gourmet. Like, we both are aware of this thing, yet it only lasted this very small amount of time.
Well, I think, it was 1970, late 60s, early 70s. There were 4 channels, so there wasn't a lot of choice in cooking shows at the time. Hmm. Yeah, this and The French Chef, and him and Julia Child actually have collaborated, had collaborated, in, well, Julia Child was still alive, and I think he was a very, I don't know the right word to describe his personality.
Ebullient?
Ebullient. It's a good word for it. And
effervescent?
Yeah. I believe, let's see, a food writer, Michael Field, called Kerr the Liberace of the food world.
You know, I feel like that is an accurate assessment. And also, well, he was a snappy dresser, I guess.
Yeah, at the time that you watch the video, he's dressed nicely.
He is. He's a dashing fellow. I could see being rather taken with him. I mean, my 12-year-old self was.
But I had never watched this before, and I don't like him. I don't like him. I think that's where I'm at.
Really?
I find him troubling.
You know, that's the thing about him is I feel like intellectually I should dislike him, but I just can't.
I look into his eyes.
And you see love and
marbling. I see nothing. I see, like, it feels like he can just, he can assume any personality he wants. And he's just assuming this one because it is the most effective to make an entertaining cooking show. He has the eyes of a shark, a doll's eyes.
So, are you saying he could kill a man just as easily as braise him?
It feels like it. I don't know. I get that sense from some. Maybe it's just this personality is full. Like maybe it is not a complete construction on his part. I oftentimes see people who have this like weird ebullience, as you would call it, and think it's fake and feels like they are just putting on a show to hide something or to and especially in this case when it is being filmed, I am certain this persona is not 100% real. And that is a little bit, I find it disconcerting when someone is just so, I don't know. It's not, it's entertaining. I enjoyed watching the show. I watched it a couple times because the recipe that he uses is not written down anywhere. So we had the authentic experience of the experience of watching this and going, oh, he did this and then this and then this. I got to remember that. Oh, I forgot.
And he didn't mention this.
Yeah.
It was very disorganized.
No, it's not. And that's the other thing. It's not, a cooking show. I think there's a lots of different kinds of cooking shows, you know, and we just came off Julia Child and hers was largely educational, informative. Here is how to cook this thing. Here's how to take care of your knives. Do this. And then you do this. And there may be a joke or two, but mostly it is about the onions. And this, I don't know what he's doing half the time. He's just like, chop, 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 chop. Oh, I'm making a joke about this. So I'm like, well,
he's doing Italian karate.
Sure. He is also, you know, or being racist or
homophobic. Yeah, that was real hard.
Or homophobic. Both of those things.
I don't remember that. I didn't pick up on that, but I'm sure that does track.
He has like a producer or something that's off camera, right off camera, and he was talking to him multiple times throughout the show.
I liked that a lot.
But he was calling that man, he was making joke about that man being a homosexual.
Oh, was he?
Yes, he did. It was after the tomatoes. I believe this was.
Oh, I thought he was just making a body. I thought he was being ribald.
He was being ribald by insinuating that that gentleman didn't like a naked tomato, which meant, oh, he's gay.
I didn't pick up on that, but it's entirely possible, and I'm not going to defend him. I feel as though Graham Kerr is not a hateful man. I feel as though if you were to talk to him today, he'd probably say, yeah, that was not, in, you know, that's not appropriate.
Well, I mean, surely, and this is that's the other strange thing about this, in that after the show, after the car accident, and him and his wife in particular had multiple health problems, diagnosed with lung cancer, and then it turns out, actually, it was tuberculosis, which is also bad. They converted to Christianity, and he converted to, like, low-fat cooking.
Yeah, didn't he get? I read an article where he like got into an argument with his wife, like shortly before she passed away, over like her feeding their grandchild like a piece of bologna. I believe he referred to it as poison. I think he's dialed back a little bit, and now he's just sort of a kindly old man that, you know, is sort of trying to be more healthy. It's weird. It's very strange what happens to people.
I don't know. I find that maybe that's the other unsettling. I strongly dislike this, the healthy cooking, low fat cooking. So it's bad. It's bad. There's nothing wrong with using fat in cooking. It's in moderation like everything else. It's okay.
Well, and that's fanaticism, I think, is the problem with anything. You know, anyone who is, you know, fanatical about anything, you know, on the one spectrum you have Paula Deen and, you know, we're just going to refer to her food. We're not going to talk about her personality problems, but like the Paula Deen approach of like, you know, butter and mayonnaise. And that's like this fanaticism toward that, where it's like, you know, there's almost this fetishizing of like food that is bad for you in a healthy age. And then the other end of like super hyper healthy food. It's like, you can't treat food like poison, and you can't treat it like this, like golden, like chalice.
I mean,
it's a problem.
Paula Deen as a whole, I would say that's not really necessarily only a Paula Deen thing. The Paula Deen thing is she cooks Southern food, and I think the larger problem is that Southern food is, you know, that is like three episodes of a podcast if we're going to be talking, if we're dissecting like Southern
the
food.
The Southern approach to what is called salad.
Southern food culture
is troubling.
And its legacy in slave cooking and black culture, like it's. That's a bigger problem for Paula Deen to me than just, oh yeah, she likes butter a lot, is her kind of usurping basically what this episode is actually about. Soul food. Griot is soul food. Griot and grits is soul food. Which, and that's the other thing about this, I think, is Graham Kerr, British man, who lived in New Zealand and then Australia, and then this is filmed in Ottawa in Canada.
Oh.
And then it was syndicated lots of places, but it was filmed. All those people in the audience are Ottawans, Canadians.
Ah, see.
But he is the least soul food dude. Like, I cannot. He's like, he apologizes in the little intro. He hates grits, and I don't want to take the soul out of soul food. I'm like, dude, everything in this episode is taking the soul out of soul food. This is the least soul foody, he uses. So griot, what is griot? Let's start there. I think we should probably establish what griot is before we break into it. Griot is a, in the general sense of the recipe, is generally a tougher cut of steak, top flank or something, that you slow cook with a lot of vegetables and you make a kind of a gravy type sauce. Is that, you think that's appropriate?
I think so. What happened with my griot, I don't know how traditional it was. Because no. this was a hard recipe to understand exactly what it was.
Yeah. Well, the fact is that we're caught in between, really. Because the Galloping Gourmet, this recipe that he uses on the show, is not proper griot. It is
this phantom recipe that doesn't exist anywhere.
Yeah, you can't find it written down anywhere. If we wrote it down...
It was kind of cool to like not be able to find something on the internet.
Yeah, you had to actually watch the thing and make notes and remember. So he doesn't do typical griot. He uses veal. I think the biggest difference is that he uses veal instead of a tougher cut of meat. I think he probably does that because he's making a cooking show and he has to cook something in half an hour. So he doesn't, veal can, you could cook up very quickly. You know, he doesn't want to spend hours cooking, simmering tough cuts of meat, you know. So that's my guess is why he uses veal. What did you use, Yusuf? What kind of?
I used top sirloin. Okay. I think. What did I use? I used beef. Obviously, I don't know the exact cut. I think it was like top round.
Yeah, which is I think generally what people use or something very similar to that.
Yeah,
I was gonna go, oh, I'll do what if you're going to do a more traditional thing, I was like, I'll do what he does. I'll just copy his recipe, even if it's not authentic, you know, quote unquote, mm-hmm. quote unquote authentic. I could not find veal anywhere.
Really? That's odd to me. I wonder if that's a regulation thing or what, you know, because there are not very many things I stand up for. You know, there are not many sort of like protests or whatever that I will engage in because I'm just a lazy and selfish person. But I just don't eat veal.
I mean, it's not, you can't defend it, really. It's not like it's, you know, it's pretty brutal kind of awful thing. But I mean, all meat really.
Apparently there's
factory farming is very
ethical,
bad.
Ethical veal is kind of a thing.
Ethical veal. All right. Sure.
Okay. If you're in Britain, and this, I might be 100% wrong, but apparently you can't buy, you know, veal where it's like put in the, you know, little container and like, you know, fed things that like just fed milk.
Mm-hmm.
They feed it normal things that a baby cow would eat. And, you know, I don't think they put it in a crate. It's probably not like, you know, like, you know, they don't show it cartoons or anything. It's not like, you know. Okay, it's not like Wagyu or anything, but and they do ultimately kill it as a child. But it's better, I think.
It is, yes, less torture is better. But I couldn't find veal. It doesn't, like, regardless, I could not find
like,
any veal
at all.
I mean, if I went to a butcher, I'm sure I could have gotten some, but I went to grocery mm-hmm. stores. I am not going to a meat market. So
you could have asked your butcher about where to find some good knives.
I could have done that, but I did not. I got a veal tenderloin instead. Because he uses a veal tenderloin. I got a pork tenderloin, I should say.
Oh, sorry. Pork tenderloin.
I misspoke. A pork tenderloin and just did the same thing he does, but with a pork tenderloin.
Oh, how long did you cook it?
The same time, like 5 minutes, you know?
Really?
Like cut it up thinly and, you know, covered it. I diverged from his recipe in that I used a pork tenderloin. I did not use regular flour. I used coconut flour. And I did not.
Why did you use coconut flour?
Because coconut flour is low carb and regular flour is not. And I use cauliflower rice instead of his long grain normal rice.
And how is cauliflower rice? Is it?
It is largely.
Is it dry?
No, it's actually the opposite. It's
like when it's before it's been prepared. Is it dry or is it?
No, it's. I mean, is cauliflower dry?
I don't. Is it just like chopped up cauliflower to make it look like rice?
Yeah, it's riced cauliflower, riced thing. You can rice things other than just rice. You know, it's a verb. You just chop it up very fine. But we buy it pre-riced because you can do. I've done it. We've done it ourselves many times, but it is a pain and it makes a giant mess. I buy the bag that they have in the freezer section and I just reheat it.
I see.
It's identical. You can't.
That's cool.
That's
great.
In most applications. Rice is a delivery system for meat and sauce.
Oh no, Robbie. Robbie. Oh, Robbie.
The flavor is, I don't know. I can't, it's not that big a deal. Sushi, I would say yes. In sushi applications, I would not use cauliflower rice. I would use regular rice. However,
rice may be the single most important food to me on the planet.
Well, I like rice a lot, Yusuf. Unfortunately, rice has lots of
delivery. System.
It has lots of carbohydrates in it, all right? And I'm at the moment not eating very many. I am trying to avoid carbohydrates.
It's good to take care of yourself.
Because
I should eat less rice than I do.
I need to be.
And would eat more rice than I do.
I need to be less Robbie.
For my wife.
I need to be less Robbie. There's too much of me.
Too many Robbies.
There's too many Robbies. But that's how I varied. I still use the same vegetables. I used his precious arrowroot powder.
I could not find arrowroot.
You didn't go. You got to go to the Green Y section of Publix. They have arrowroot. They have it in like a little pouch.
I asked the Publix people.
Don't that's.
And they're like, it's over here by these other things. And I looked in the two places. They don't have arrowroot. I could have gotten tapioca. Well, first of all, let us say arrowroot. It's like a thickening agent. So
right.
That means it's French AF, bro. So French.
Arrowroot powder is not French at all. I mean, it is. Well, it's Creole.
It's a thickening agent.
It's Creole.
Thickeners.
It's used in Cajun and Creole cooking.
Are they referred to as Italian Creole people? Are they Pakistani Creole? No, they're French Creole.
That's not the same. A person from France is not the same as if I'm from Louisiana. If you have French descendants, that's great, but you're not from France.
Well, arrowroot powder like is Italians not. Italians who refer to like spaghetti sauce as gravy. They are very, in their minds, very Italian.
Also wrong.
But as we saw on The Sopranos, when Tony Soprano et al. Went over to the motherland, and he's like, oh, where's the gravy? And they're like, we do not know. Come si dice gravy? Right? What, we have our identities.
What are we talking
that
about?
We are, that we think of ourselves. Let's start. And then when we meet the people from the homeland, they're like,
I don't have a homeland, Yusef. New Jersey, I guess. South Jersey is my homeland, if you want to be very, which is not.
The land of Jimmy Hoffa's body.
I don't have, no, South Jersey is not Jimmy Hoffa's body.
Is South Jersey where the farms are?
Yeah, South Jersey is farmland. It's closer to Philadelphia identity than to New York identity.
Right.
New Jersey doesn't even have its own thing, really. New Jersey is just like whatever biggest city is adjacent, is it becomes like a mutated form of that. So South Jersey is farms and weird Philadelphia identity. North Jersey is factories and weird mutated New York identity to me.
Where fake banana flavor comes from.
I like fake banana flavor.
I'm into it. Fanta banana, the one true flavor that shall unite us all.
Arrowroot powder. I use some of that. I also use xanthan gum. They're basically interchangeable. They are thickeners. They thicken up your sauce.
I used to love reading xanthan gum on labels. I thought it sounded like the coolest ingredient. I wanted anything that had xanthan gum in it, just so I could read that label.
It just makes things thick. That's all it does. If you use too much, it makes it gelatinous, which is not good. You have to be very careful about how much you use.
Used cornstarch. Yeah. I did mix some cornstarch with brandy, which is insane.
I did not use any of the alcohol either. How did the alcohol go?
It was nice. I mean, I bought some cooking sherry. And I got some I got some brandy. And so in the recipe, when you're browning the meat, because there's like two components to this recipe. You like sort of prepare the vegetables and, you know, bell pepper, celery, onion, garlic, you kind of prepare the vegetables and then you prepare the meat and then you kind of combine them. I'm browning the steak chopped up and I poured some brandy in it, or no, it was the cooking sherry, and I ignited it. Felt very I wanted a little more flambe going on, but it ignited, and that was kind of cool. That felt very fancy. I felt like fancy pants, and it was kind of cool to start a fire in my kitchen on purpose.
I texted you this. I do not introduce fire. I keep fire away from my kitchen.
Oh, fire finds me in the kitchen. I started an oven fire a couple of years ago. It was, oh my God. I thought we were going to have to move.
How?
Okay. So there was oil on something and I didn't understand. It like dripped onto the heat element and started a catastrophic fire. Like it was just, there was a fire in my oven.
How much?
It was bad.
How much oil was there? Like,
I was trying a new recipe, Robbie. I was trying to make dinner.
I've had flames in the oven, but they just burn out.
It was a lot.
It's a confined space. There's a little.
It was bad.
After the oil burns, there's nothing left to burn. It needs a fuel source.
Yes, we obviously recovered from the oven fire, but it was upsetting. And there's a lot.
Like a steady drip of oil from whatever you were cooking.
I don't know how it started, because I found out there's nothing quite so troubling as seeing flames in the little window in the oven and then saying, oh, look at that. And the house just filled with really, really bad smoke. It was like noxious in the way when you like mix cleaning agents together that aren't supposed to be cleaning agents and you have to call like a number to say, do I need to go to the hospital? And they're like, no, just sit outside for a little while. It was bad.
Okay. So you willingly brought fire back into your kitchen.
Well, I mean, you know, it was very impressive.
That is for show.
Like,
I don't need there's nothing.
Wow, fire. This is very cool.
Yeah, it's for the show. It's not for, it doesn't do anything. The fire lasts for like 8 seconds. It's not going to actually add he's just burning off the alcohol. So you just get the flavor of the liquor, which no, thank you.
I like the tang. Well, you don't like pickles.
No.
Which is weird to me. So you just don't like any sort of acidic, like tanginess. That's not going to work for you.
Largely no.
Okay.
I'm not gonna paint a broad brush and say everything is bad, but I generally don't like the tomatoes in this were almost a bridge too far for me.
Really? Wow.
I don't like raw tomatoes. I don't really like cooked tomatoes. I like tomato sauce, which is basically just sugar. So that's not really.
So let's talk about the tomatoes. Did you blanch them?
No, I also cheated with the tomatoes. I bought a can of tomatoes that were diced and ready. I did not do his thing.
I thought about getting the diced tomatoes, but I figured, you know, I've never actually done this with the peeling of the tomato. Because normally, if I was going to do this recipe, I'd probably just have the skins in. Like, that's just a thing that you... I mean, does it reduce bitterness to, like, get rid of the skins?
I assume so. It probably is also a texture thing. The skins probably are, you know, tougher. So,
maybe they don't kind of, because there weren't really discrete tomatoes or really the vegetables just in general sort of congealed into, and this sounds disgusting, but they congealed into kind of a sauce, which at first I was thinking, oh God, we're going to have to order pizza tonight. Like I'm making this recipe and, you know, a horrendous amount of prep. For what it was, like, I just didn't think, wow, this is going to be easy peasy, but it was a lot. And then, you know, I'm making it and it's not transforming in a way where it looks like this is going to be food.
I was
real worried about this recipe.
I didn't cook my vegetables that much. They were soft, but they did not form into an unrecognizable mush. I could see, hey, that was a pepper. That was an onion. That was mm-hmm. a tomato. I can still see the shape. That's a cucumber. Not cucumber. That's a celery. No cucumbers. Celery.
That would be weird. Okay. So, yeah. Because I did the, you know, I browned the meat and then I, you know, sherried it and ignited it. And that was delightful. And then once the meat was kind of in a good spot, I diverged a little bit from what he did because he was doing the veal. And, you know, all the recipes I saw for grillade had, like, you know, this braises overnight. This is,
yes,
you know, many hours. You know, I saw not overnight, but hours. I saw crock pot recipes, you know, anything. Given what I understood about, like, what it was supposed to be, like, he's cooking it and, you know, he's cooking the meat maybe 20 minutes.
Well,
like, that's not going to happen.
I mean, he
did do a switch.
No, he cooked it for maybe like 8 minutes because his pans were not hot, which was a big, this episode, he was full of lots of like moving things around because his pans weren't hot to begin with. They weren't ready to cook with.
Or the water had boiled out of the pot for the tomatoes.
Yes.
He was very disorganized, much like my conversation with you about this, because we're just like jumping back and forth. But that's kind of what this episode was.
I mean, yeah, the episode itself is very messy, it feels like. And I think that's part of the charm of this, of the Galloping Gourmet. The supposed charm is, you know, he is crazy and he makes little jokes everywhere. And some of them are people laugh and some of them are like, what is this madman doing? What is he talking about? And the recipe itself is pretty simple. It is, you cook meat and you make a pan sauce with vegetables, the gravy. You thicken mm-hmm. it up as much as you want. Like, you could throw cream in there if you wanted to. He doesn't use it. He just uses stock and arrowroot powder and flour mm-hmm. And butter. But you could, and oil. But you could easily throw cream in there. Yeah, you could throw some cream in there, lighten it up a little bit. Let it simmer a little bit. Like, cook off some of the water, and then it will give it a creamier texture. It makes it more unctuous. It makes it, the mouthfeel, as people like to say.
Ah, yes.
Mouthfeel.
Yeah, I associate that with beer snobs.
I mean, it's kind of food snobs in general. And beer snobs are there, but there's also, you know, wine connoisseurs also care about the mouthfeel, and so do food people. You know, sauces in general are very mouthfeel, texture. It's very important. But the rest of this itself is not that complicated. I mean, all it is the time. Like, if you're using, like, a veal, which is a low-fat meat, you're going to cook it very quickly. The pork I used, I cook it very quickly, and then it was done. And then I took it off the heat. But the vegetables are just, like, cutting up vegetables, let them simmer, let them cook in the oil, garlic, you know. It's very simple stuff. It just, he doesn't like grits, so he uses rice instead.
Hmm.
Which
I had to braise this thing for an hour and a half.
Well, you did the proper thing. It feels like I have not researched the journey of the griot recipe. If it's soul food, it probably is. We're poor people. We can only afford poor people cuts of meat. To make them tasty, you have to braise them and let them simmer for a long time so you break down the connective tissue. I imagine that, and that's what, like, that's the other thing. It's very strange to me. The Galloping Gourmet, like, if you look at all the foods he's cooked all these episodes, they're almost all, like, very fancy, like, recipes that I would not even endeavor to cook on my own. Like there was one that was a lamb saddle. Like, he cooked an entire saddle of a lamb. And then, and I was like, what? Who on earth would actually... No.
The recipe I sent you involved a process called larding, which is where you inject fat into a piece of meat, like with a special larding needle. It's insane.
So this, like, soul food in general is poor people food. It is food for people who can't afford good cuts of meat and can't like, hey, we can afford this top round or whatever it is, and then we cook it for a long time, and we probably cook it overnight. And then have a sauce, and then you throw it on grits, which is also poor people food.
It's excuse me. It's very weird, kind of how, like, well, I don't know. I mean, you make some, you know, it's like, okay, there's the necessity of, like, I'm going to use this cheaper cut of meat. I'm going to have to figure out a way to make it delicious. And then you succeed and you make it delicious. And then now that becomes a fancy brunch thing.
Yeah, that's the thing that I don't quite understand about how this is a brunch meal. Like, because that's...
Yesterday I had some work done on my car. And so I went to a diner in the morning and I had a patty melt. So breakfast is just a time. I don't understand why people... I would eat clam chowder for breakfast. I would eat anything for breakfast.
I think breakfast food, people call things breakfast food, is because largely people who are eating big breakfasts are people who are working in, like, physical labor, and they need to carb load in the morning so they have energy to get through the day. And that's why I think eggs and biscuits and gravy and pancakes and all, like bacon, like all those kinds of foods became breakfast foods, is because, you know, it's a farmer's meal. It is, you're working all day. You need energy to burn. You have fuel to burn. But brunch food, when you say brunch and brunch meals, I have a very specific idea of what it is. It is not a, like, hearty, savory umami.
Yeah, but
I'm not looking for umami, basically.
But
what about
and grits? Shrimp and grits is a very brunchy food.
I don't eat...
I've seen you eat shrimp and grits at brunch, sir.
I know you have, but that was because we had a place that I've never had the shrimp and grits. And I'm never going to go back there for dinner. So I took the opportunity. Because everywhere I go, if they have shrimp and grits, I try the shrimp and grits. Because I have a taxonomy. I have a ranking of shrimp and grits, of all the shrimp and grits I've ever eaten in my entire life, and I add to it at every opportunity that I can, whatever restaurant it is. I don't care what it is. If it's a fancy place, if it's a diner, if they have shrimp and grits, I'm trying it, and it's going on the list.
Okay, so what is the essential component of, like, really good grits for you?
Texture.
Okay, but, like, describe the texture.
It's not soft. It's the same thing as pasta. It is the el dente. It is that toothiness, the bite that just, it's slight, the slight toothiness. It is not, it's not soft, which is the, I don't know. He just had pictures, you know, of the restaurant he went to. He didn't have video. We saw pictures of him scooping up the grits he had and mixing it with food. Those grits looked god awful. So I don't blame him for not liking those grits. That he says that's the first time I've eaten grits. I'm like, well, don't say.
How would you know you don't like them?
Yeah, they look. Those look like bad grits. Those look like people. Like that's the thing. People say I don't like grits. I'm like, well, you probably had bad grits. Like, good grits are very, very good. And he's like, it's like a bad semolina. I'm like, actually, they're the same thing. Grits and semolina are, like, 1 degree apart from each other. Grits are well-prepared. Grits have the good texture. They are salted and buttered. And that's all you need, really, for good grits. I did not make any because, again, grits are full of carbohydrates. They're not – I still love grits. I think grits are great. But they have to be made well. And like instant grits are terrible. Like that's the thing I take from
some pretty good instant grits. You've had my shrimp and grits.
I have. And I'm not saying
okay, I need to know. Tell me what you think of my shrimp and grits. Be honest.
They're good.
Is that like what you would say to a child who made you a painting?
No, oh, I would say it's good. It's above the Mendoza line.
Okay.
They are acceptable form of shrimp and grits. I will eat them again if given the opportunity.
My grits are pretty good. I feel like I go to places and my grits, I enjoy my grits. I'm not going to say they're better, but I enjoy my grits more than most grits I try, which almost ruins me on shrimp and grits because like the shrimp is usually fine, but the grits is the pain point for me because usually they're like flavorless.
Well, that's the thing. No one knows what they're doing with like the people. If you're eating grits out, it's usually like, oh, we have grits because they're cheap and easy to make and we can make a bunch of it for nothing. Like Cracker Barrel grits, terrible.
Oh, I was just going to say that.
Cracker Barrel grits are awful.
It's like a glue soup.
Yeah, they don't know what they're doing. They make like probably like a 10-gallon pot and just like dump it into a little bowl every time for like the hundreds of people that come in. They're terrible. You can't
simultaneously over and undercooked. They're in the same way.
And a lot of diners do the same thing. You can tell a good diner is this if they actually make the grits the right way. But there's very few that do that. I don't know why, but that's the thing. Like it's usually griot and grits. It is griot with the grits. But this time we're using we both made rice, which is fine. Yes. Like the starch is it's your preference. Like I don't begrudge Graham Kerr for going, I don't like grits, I made rice instead. That's fine. I think that's actually like the fact that he takes a kind of the normal recipe and does his own thing with it in this episode. I don't begrudge him that because I like rice more. So I'm like, oh, that's fine. Use rice. That's okay. It's okay to do like I think that's okay to do with food. I think a lot of people are very precious with recipes and they go, you can't change it. I'm like, well, actually, you can easily change a lot of recipes for. Like, it might be worse, but, you know, you never know. You got to try. Once you get the basis of what is happening to the food in this, you like rice more than grits, then make rice. If you like veal more than, you know, a top round, then use veal. It's fine. Just understand that you're diverging.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to stick to his recipe as much as I could. You know, I did make some changes and I ended up not cooking it, you know, for 8 minutes, but I cooked it for an hour and a half. So I guess I made some pretty big changes, but those changes those were just practical. Like if I'm going to see this thing through, I need to cook this longer. But I did try to kind of do it as he did it, just to kind of see, you know, this is like his approach to it. And I mean, we already talked about how his recipe and his like delivery style for that was very disorganized and very hard to follow. Like I watched it several times and made notes and changed things. And I actually had two drafts of my notes because like I took the one, you know, as I was taking the notes and then another where I organized it into ingredients and steps. And it was just, I mean, this was very hard to follow the way he presented it. Enjoyable to watch because of his personality and, you know, just this like, you know, bubbly thing he has going on, which I kind of felt delightful, but it is very much style over substance. But I did try to kind of follow it as best as I could. And if I were to make this again, I don't know if we're at that stage of the conversation. If I were to make this again, I definitely would have done it differently and, you know, done things like I probably would have salted the meat ahead of time, which is something I would normally do. And I would have, you know, obviously browned it, maybe used the sherry. I don't know. But it would have been, I would have tucked in for more of a long cook. And I probably would have added the vegetables maybe a little later. So I don't know. I didn't, it became gluey and weird.
That's probably how much, well, I don't know. That probably too much thickening is the problem. Like if you're, depending on the measure of thickening agents you're using, you know, the cornstarch plus the, you know, did you cover the meat and flour before you ground it? That will add, you know, like all that stuff adds up. And eventually, you know, if you, along with the fat, it will, could get too gluey, too kind of gelatinous at times.
Well, I probably should rephrase that because I was expecting something with more discrete vegetables.
So you just got a mush.
Well, I mean, it became a sauce, which was kind of cool. But it was weird because, you know, flavor wise, this was almost indistinguishable from I do like an okra stew.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the flavors were just like the beef kind of did that. And it was like the okra stew, but instead of a stew, the stew became a sauce. And so, you know, which would probably work for people who don't like okra. And I guess, you know, the sort of okra has kind of a natural thickening agent in it.
Yep.
So I don't really add starch or anything like that. But
the slime.
My wife isn't really into the slime, which is, I totally get it. It's you can overdo and it's gross. So I'll generally pan fry those and add them a little later into the process. So it's mainly like the beef that's been browned is stewing in this sort of tomato base kind of thing. So I could see adding some of the elements from this, you know, the fresh tomatoes, you know, this has a lot of onions and garlic, like that stew has those. The celery was weird for me and the bell pepper was weird, but they kind of worked. I probably wouldn't add the celery next time. And I would add okra. Basically, what I'm saying is if I made this again, I'd just make okra stew. It was kind of indistinguishable.
I don't know. This is feels like very much meat and vegetables with a thick gravy sauce, gravy type sauce. It's not quite gravy, I would call it, but it is close. And it was good in that regard. I enjoyed it. I liked my meal. It is a little too much for me on a normal day to make this much food. To have that many different vegetables. I am not a person that is going to have five different vegetables in a meal. I will pick one or two and go, that's my vegetables. I'm doing okay. That's enough vegetables.
Really?
Yeah. And especially with using cauliflower rice, that is additional vegetable on top of things. But it was fine. I think if I was going to make it again, I would make it very traditional. I would go with the top round. I would slow cook it. I would probably put it in a crock pot.
Yeah, I could see this being a pretty great crock pot meal, provided you brown the meat before you throw it in the crock pot.
Yeah. Yes.
But yeah, no, I that's probably how I would make this again if I did. Because, you know, I obviously wouldn't want to do okra stew in a crock pot because that would just turn into a gluey, nasty mess. It would be gross. I like it on the gluier side just because that's kind of how growing up, that's how it was. But I definitely, it seems more palatable because that's like the traditional, like in my brain, this is how growing up okra stew was. But the way I make it now with the sort of kind of, I brown the okra and I kind of have them in bigger pieces just in case, you know, you don't want to eat them and you can pick them out. And I found that doing that makes it a little more like traditionally palatable. And so that would definitely not be a crock pot meal.
No, I mean,
it was good. I liked it. And honestly, I had some today just because I had a little left over and I just had some, actually I had for breakfast because why not, with some rice. And it was really good. Like it was even better.
I mean, generally that's the if you let it sit, the sauces come together better overnight, which is why this is a, you know, cook overnight kind of meal generally, or like cook it, let it sit in the refrigerator, let it ferment sort of, and let eat it again as leftovers. And it's actually, you know, like pasta, spaghetti's generally better on the second day. And so is these types of sauces a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your rice, Yusuf.
Okay, let's talk about rice. Rice is the most important thing. I could eat rice literally every day, three times a day, like a child. What's that?
I don't like. What do you mean, like a child? You think eating the same thing a lot is a childlike behavior?
I think so. Yes, because children haven't been alive for very long, and you know, it apparently is a massive struggle to get them to eat anything. So if you go with something that works, that's just, all right, here you go. Please eat. Please take care of yourself. I don't want to go to jail.
Okay. But you are specifying, I believe it was called Persian style is what you called this, the
yeah,
method?
Yeah. Well, growing up, my dad was from Iran.
Right.
And so rice was kind of, that was our, and he did a lot of the cooking in the household. And so, you know, that was sort of, that was our starch. And so we would do rice, and basically you, you want to get like a long grain rice, like preferably basmati. Weirdly, the store didn't have like a big enough bag of basmati. They had like a tiny bag of basmati that was like, what is this? This is like for somebody cooking a recipe. This is stupid. So I like a big, you know, big bag of basmati. So I just got regular, like extra long grain rice. So anyway, you want to use like a long grain rice that has less starch than like your, like the opposite would be like a sushi rice that like sticks together. Mm-hmm. And so long grain rice is going to be less gluey, less starchy. I might get some of the terms here, like gluten and all that. Like I might get some of that wrong, but basically it's like sticky. Cause you want to have, eventually you want to have like fluffy, discrete grains of rice that don't really stick together that you can't, like that you can't use chopsticks for. It's like fluffy and separate, discrete grains. So anyway, you soak the rice in like some salt and some water. So some people like to soak it for hours. I soak it for about 20 minutes, basically long enough for the pot of water to boil. So I have a separate pot of water. Once the water's boiling, I drain the rice and rinse it, you know, to get some of the starch out. Mm-hmm. Then I boil that in the water for about 5 minutes, you know, parboil it or whatever you want to call it. I drain that. I rinse it off again to get out more starch. And then I put it in a pot, another pot that I put vegetable oil. Some people put butter. Some people put both. And then I put that in the pot, put the rice in the pot, simmer it on like 5 out of 10, cover it in either a towel or I think the traditional thing is like a, it's called a darmouche, I think. I don't know. It's basically like a towel to absorb moisture. I use paper towels now.
Okay.
And then I basically, you know, cook that for, at home, it's 19 minutes, you know, but you'll say 20 minutes. And then at the end, you have this beautiful, fluffy golden rice. And on the bottom is this crunchy crust called tadig. And it is the most spectacular thing that can happen to rice.
I don't think you've ever made this for me.
Crunchy cake of rice.
I've never eaten this from you.
I'll make you some tadig, bro.
I would like to try this.
It's super good.
It sounds good.
It's, you know, like when you get like bibimbap and like the bottom of the pot has like a couple crusty bits of rice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or like when you get like the corner of the lasagna and it's like kind of the hard bit. It's kind of like that.
Right.
And like the tadig is, you know, that's like, that's the part that everybody likes. Like that is, you know, the crunchy rice is what it is all about. Some people like to do tadig with potatoes, which is like, I have potatoes with my rice. It's just, it's basically diabetes. It's amazing.
I mean, I've eaten pasta sandwiches, so you're not
Oh yeah, no, we have both like espoused the virtues of the pasta sandwich.
Carbs on carbs are totally okay with me.
Oh, absolutely. When I do spaghetti, like if I do like steamed spaghetti, like Persian style spaghetti, I put potatoes on the bottom and get like crunchy potato, crunchy pasta. But I also serve it with yogurt. Like I just pour cold yogurt on top of it and hot sauce. So it's, I love taking that to work because my coworkers just look at me like I'm a monster. It's delicious though.
I mean, like the cold, I'm sure, and the hot, I'm and the sure steak, it is.
It's spectacular, but you look like a crazy person with your like bowl of spaghetti that you just dump cold yogurt onto and then cover in sriracha.
It's, you know what, you're not, you may look like a crazy person, but you don't, you know, it's not microwaving fish at work. You know, there's a line.
Yeah,
where I think there's a line of being, you're the weirdo that eats, you know, yogurt on your spaghetti, but it's not the smelling up the break room kind of
person. That's true. I have done that a couple times.
You're
I
a feel monster. Kind of bad. You like are if a I monster.
Do,
you
I,
are
I a realized, monster. I realized it was, I crossed a line. And so if I make, like fish or I'll just like have like a sausage or something that I bring to work. Cause usually, you know, like if I, when the school year is in full effect, I will make extra dinner so that lunches happen.
Right. Lunches.
Cause I cannot eat food from a school cafeteria because it is literally how you remember it.
I mean, you know how, I don't know. I think I eat enough school food that everyone had their own kind of life hacks for making the food edible.
Really?
Yes. I don't know. I did. I was like, okay, oh, it's the square pizza day. This is what I'll do to make this better. this is how I make this taste like like food. You know, there's and every day had its different. There were biscuits, I think, and I soaked them in chocolate milk.
Oh God!
To make them palatable.
Oh, you were you that monster who would pour everything all together, mix
no.
all the things?
No, I'm not saying no, not everything, just the biscuits. Were any of the
God, the fact that you feel like that separates you from those monsters.
The biscuits were terrible and dry without some sort of moisture, and chocolate milk is what I had.
Lunch is hard when you're a kid. I remember in kindergarten, Ricardo had a hot dog.
Wait a second.
Every day.
Wait, I want to stop right now. Wait 1 minute.
What?
You knew a kid in kindergarten named Ricardo?
Yes. And he was also S. Like, we dressed up as letters from the alphabet, and I wanted to be Super Sox. And Ricardo had a much better Super Socks outfit than I had. I had socks long.
What is
and
Super
then
Socks?
I had a cape that I... Well, S, you know, the alliterative nature of S, the S sound, Super Socks.
I understand that, but you just made that up?
We had a parade of letters.
You just made up...
It was a very big kindergarten thing.
I don't...
And
no,
I wanted to be Super Socks. Super Socks outfit than me. I just had some stupid blanket, but that weirdo every day ate a cold hot dog for lunch. Cold hot dog.
You got to slow down.
What is that?
You got to slow down. You're hitting me with too much stuff yourself. Okay. You are talking, the way you said all that, you were talking as if Super Socks was like some property that I am supposed to recognize and not something that you created as a 7-year-old or whatever.
I didn't create anything. This is what the teacher, they wanted us to learn our letters.
So your teacher just made up some Super Socks character, like a superhero
I remember we had the letters on the wall. As I think is probably traditional.
Yeah.
And every letter kind of was anthropomorphized.
Oh, God.
And the best one
was Super Socks. Okay.
Super Socks. Because it looked like a little superhero.
Right.
And
I understand.
So I had my socks, big socks, and like a blanket around my neck tied around like a cape. I felt like I was.
Right. And then Ricardo. King of town. Ricardo stole your thunder. The kid who ate cold hot dogs for lunch.
Yeah. Clearly, their love was not manifesting in lunch variety. It was manifesting in costume quality.
Griad.
Griad.
That all this ties back.
Yes. The Galloping Gourmet Griad. Super Socks. It is all together. We are all one, Robbie.
I would not be revisiting the Galloping Gourmet.
I don't think there's much. I feel like I get it, and I understand, and I kind of like the insane style over substance. But as far as like what I like about cooking and cooking shows, this is really kind of not it. I enjoyed him, but this was very cult of personality. You know, the celebrity chef before that was a thing. I mean, he kind of was the archetype for that, you know, very like, you know, out there personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely appreciate the Julia Child approach much better. The theory, the practicality of it, the, you know, you could save time here, but let's make it better. But it's not like she wouldn't use words like elevated or anything like that. She's making food that is practical food, given a massive amount of time available to you either as a professional chef or a homemaker. And what the Galloping Gourmet is sort of like, all right, common people, please get a glimpse of this fancy thing. I'm going to this restaurant in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I'm going to bring it to you in Ottawa, Canada. And I like that, too. I think that's interesting. I think it's like maybe bringing something beyond just like, we're going to boil some potatoes and like, you know, have literally meat and potatoes for dinner. Like, maybe let's try something else. As far as following his recipe, it was a nightmare, and he was super disorganized.
He was. I think it was largely a product of his pans not being ready when he needed them, so he had to shift his the order of things around a lot. And that's the other thing, and you alluded to it, is this doesn't feel like a show where you're supposed to be making this. Like, this doesn't feel like a show where you're watching a dude cook. And he's being very entertaining and insane, psychotic, I would say. But
yes,
because but you're not, you're supposed to be like, this is like a entertainment. It is not teaching you how to cook this thing. It is like, hey, you just cut it. Look at this green pepper. It is, there's water coming out of it. I'm squeezing it like a maniac.
Yeah. I'm assuming that was roasted.
I have no idea.
I did not roast my pepper. That was the least appetizing piece of food I think I've ever seen on television.
And that's the thing. Like, and he's drinking, and he has the wine, and he's literally jumping over chairs. He is the galloping gourmet. He has the food at the end. He brings in a lady from the audience, and they eat together. And like, it's the opposite of what I want in a cooking show.
I agree.
You know, my favorite shows are always like, here's how you do this. Here's why the things happen in this food. Here's some understanding. If there's entertainment along with for the ride, that's all well and good, but it must communicate the information first. And fat's not evil. You can cook with fat all you want. It's okay, guys. It's not going to give you it's not going to give you heart disease.
Yes. You can't, like I said earlier, you can't treat food like poison. Should you have, you know, this giant piece of meat every day? No, you really shouldn't. But do you need to, like, say, oh, I can't eat a steak ever again? Like,
yeah.
I mean, unless you don't want to eat steak, don't eat steak. But, yeah. Like, I don't know. It is interesting, though, because when you think about food, or at least it's interesting to me, I don't know. When you think about food, so much of it is, you know, like you know, you have to eat, obviously. So if you have to prepare food for other people, you have to procure the food and then make something that has, you know, that's palatable, you know, for picky eaters or just, you know, just so you're not eating the same thing all the time, like a child. But then, you know, is also somewhat nutritious, but is also, you know, not a nightmare to cook and maybe not super expensive if that's a concern. And so it's, you know, all these factors going into it, you can spend a lot of time trying to figure it out. And, you know, like there are certain things that you can make that are just not worth it, either because they're really expensive or really labor intensive, or, you know, they're not labor intensive and they're not expensive, but they're gross. And there's all these different factors that are sort of battling each other. And so it's interesting to think about expanding your food horizons and being aware of new types of food. And you know, if you're in watching TV in the 70s, you know, this is probably, you know, sowing maybe a seed of like, wow, you know, there's food out there that, you know, I can go to this fancy restaurant, which I'm probably not going to go to. But like, it's like, this is how it's made. This is like, peer back behind the curtain. And there's this guy who's talking to me and he's making it accessible, kind of. I don't know. I think it's interesting. I definitely see the appeal to cooking shows and this type of cooking show especially.
We are spoiled with our exposure to other places now with the internet and with the variety and options we have in seeing. Like, I've never been to New Orleans, but I have seen many, 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 many videos of people going there and eating things and trying things and cooking things. And this, you know, in probably 1970, you're not going to see a bunch of some British guy, look, him making griot. That yes. is a thing that they make there. Isn't that interesting? I also make racism jokes. Isn't that funny about Asian people?
Yeah, that was very, what was the nationality? He was talking about Singapore?
Yeah, Singapore.
Filipino?
I think it was Singapore. You're right.
Okay.
I think it was Singapore.
Thailand? It was Singapore.
It doesn't really matter because
it was just so off color.
I mean,
my God.
Time and place. It's Ottawa. It's 1970. He's a British guy who's I don't expect him to be better of anyone at that time to be better, but it's still off putting when you look back and you're like, oh right, that's what things were like in 50 years ago.
That's true. That is true. Not okay.
Not but, okay.
You know, that's what it was.
That's
but I don't
less,
know.
Less racism in Julia Child.
Yes. Like, Julia Child is 100%. Like she's winning. You know, if we were doing ranking of chefs, obviously, obviously, Julia Child
is number one with a bullet.
Oh, 1,000 bullets. She just.
Oh wow.
Pow.
Papow. I don't think I have anything else I want to mention, Yusef. Is there anything you wanted we haven't talked about?
No. I mean, we got to talk about Tadig, which,
we did.
Honestly, you have to seek it out. It's a hard thing to find in a restaurant because the rice has to be made then and there because you can't, it's like that's the part that is not going to, you know, go to leftovers. And if you like cook it and like I had to separate it from the rice because it was kind of like uncertain when we were going to have dinner. I was still waiting for Megan to come home. So it's kind of like I didn't want it to be gross. So I kind of took the rice and separated it from the tadig and kept the tadig, you know, in the microwave to kind of keep it warm. But it's ephemeral like French fries. And it's spectacular. So I don't know. You probably have to just find an Iranian to make it for you.
What are the things you like to plug, Yusef? What are things people should check out?
You could check out my Dunescapes at portaki.bandcamp.com. You can just listen to them if you want or don't. I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the internet. It's not a thing.
The worst salesman I've ever heard.
I really believe in it. And I think it's very important to me. But, you know, you got to let people come to things on their own.
Here, this is me. I'll be the salesman for you. Go to portaggy.bandcamp.com to listen to Yusef's Dunescapes, an imaginary soundtrack for David Lynch's Dune film. They're very good. They're definitely worth the money. You should listen to them and pay Yusef a pittance to own them forever. And you have a band, don't you, as well, Yusef, that has released music.
We do have released music. Cassettes are selling out. We're almost out of t-shirts. We have some stickers. I will send them to you for free. mavesarcade.bandcamp.com.
I'll have links to both of those things in the show notes. I encourage you to check them out. And obviously, you don't have to. I think at this point in where we are in music and streaming technology, you don't have to disclose. You can listen to it before you buy it. I think that's understood. I think everyone knows that.
I think that maybe explains our sales figures.
I mean, you could. Doesn't Bandcamp allow you to make it so they can't listen to it before, or that you can only listen to like some of the tracks?
Like a leprechaun, you're tricking.
Thanks for joining me, Yusef. It's always a great time.
See you later, Robbie.
Thanks again to Yusef for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman, and the show's website is serofanaticist.com. You can also follow our Facebook page at facebook.com/serofanaticist. If you like the show, please give it a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. Give it 5 stars, subscribe, tell your friends, you know, all that stuff. It helps. It really does. I appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.